This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. And on today's show, you're going to meet a media titan. His name is Brad Behrens. You're probably familiar with Brad. He's the editor-in-chief and chief content officer of iMedia Communications. I got to know Brad even before the company was acquired by DMG World Media, because I used to, of course, work at AdTech, and they are under the same umbrella now. And met Brad probably in 04 or 05. And over time, he has just kind of, unveiled himself to be an incredibly complex and interesting human being. And I've wanted to get him on Dishy Mix, and luckily, he got the clearance to do that, and we're going to get to learn more about Brad. On today's show, we're going to talk about writing novels and vanity Google alerts. Do you have one? We're going to talk about the loftiest press goal that Brad can think of. We're going to discuss Facebook and kneeling chairs. We're going to chit-chat about some dude named Joseph Karabas. I've been hearing about him, and I want to know more. We're going to talk about comic books and cape fixations. We're going to talk about Shakespeare and what it is like to be a worrier. We'll talk about mass culture, media tribes, and something called the anatomization. I'm going to try to say that again. Anatomization of content. I don't know what that is. We're going to find out together.
And they are the anti-AdTech. AdTech is our sister company. AdTech is the biggest, most complicated, most amazing, immense show. It takes over the Hilton in New York. It takes over Moscone Center in San Francisco. It's crawling with thousands of people, and it's truly formidable. And iMedia is a really tiny little company with tiny little conferences, and that's why DMG, I think, purchased both of us, because it thought the two of them would go together. It's interesting because you've just jumped to the heart of the way in which my crazy career path actually makes sense. Because if you were on your iPod listening to this interview, and you rewound the last couple of minutes, and you listened to all of that again, you would think, okay, he was at Berkeley, he was in Hollywood. The guy has no stick-to-itiveness. I'm like a ping-pong ball. And yet, essentially, I've only been interested for the last 10 years in one intellectual question, and that is, what do with the media they consume? You are what you read, you are what you watch, in the same way that you are what you eat. Well, the anatomization of content, and that's the closest I can get to saying it, is very clearly understood simply by looking at what iTunes did to the concept album. I'm old enough to remember Pet Sounds. I think many of the people listening to this are. Sgt. Pepper, the other great concept album of the 60s. Those were albums in which the transition from one song to the next was significant, and the cumulative result of listening to the entire album, the entire CD, the entire collection of songs, was greater than the sum of the individual parts. That is the phenomenon. That experience has been completely destroyed by iTunes. Now, iTunes is great, and they get a tremendous amount of my money, but it is more difficult for people to experience a work in its context, in its oeuvre, within the artist's entire creative span, or simply within the confines of that individual collection of songs. You can have the impression of being close with people, of actually keeping up with them on Facebook, because everyone's publishing these little details, and it means that because it's a casual environment, the way email used to be, then I can drop a quick note to someone and say, hey, I'm trying to figure this out. Do you have any insight about this? And it's not the same as, if you'll forgive me for an overweening metaphor, Brad speaking ex cathedra as the editor-in-chief of my media. If I send somebody a note from that email address, then I'm kind of on the record in a big way. Whereas if I do a drive-by in Facebook, it's much more casual and people are less alarmed, and it's kind of nice.
Brad, welcome.
Hi, Susan.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm somewhat reluctant to be characterized as a titan of anything.
Oh, but, enjoy it.
Because I'm on a diet, you see, and so that's the idea of being titanic in any dimension is bad news. But thank you for the lovely introduction.
Well, you can be titanic in the industry, because Dishy Mix is about the people behind the business, and it's the most interesting people in the business, and it's web celebs and media mavens and media titans and, you know, all those good things. So you are one. You have a very high profile. You speak at conferences all the time. You make decisions about what gets put in print, and you have a lot of power to influence what happens in our industry. And I personally couldn't imagine that that power could be in better hands, because you're one of the most self-effacing and rational people that I get to interact with. So enjoy Titan.
Well, thank you. It's very easy, I think, to be fair when you're in the service of a community, which I am, mm-hmm. and when you serve a mission. And iMedia, like AdTech, and I think like Dishy Mix, has a very clear mission, which is we're trying to advance the cause of interactive media, particularly within marketing. So if that's the thing, if that's the lens that I'm using to focus what I do, it's a very enabling lens.
Nice. I like that you've expressed that you're in service. I think that's a really nice way to approach things. I try to focus on others as much as I can myself. So now, your title is big, long, and a little bifurcated, and I don't quite understand it. You're currently editor-in-chief and chief content officer of iMedia Communications. Are you double-dipping on salary, I hope?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know in terms of my salary. What it means is this. iMedia has two components. And the first component is the most frequent, and I think the one that people know the best because it's the most obvious, and that's iMediaConnection.com, the website, and our newsletter. But we also have, and this part of the business came first, we have the iMedia Summit. The summits are very exclusive, wonderful, 4-day events that take place several times a year. And they are the anti-AdTech. AdTech is our sister company. AdTech is the biggest, most complicated, most amazing, immense show. It takes over the Hilton in New York. It takes over Moscone Center in San Francisco. It's crawling with thousands of people, and it's truly formidable. And iMedia is a really tiny little company with tiny little conferences, and that's why DMG, I think, purchased both of us, because it thought the two of them would go together. So the editor-in-chief part of my title is with iMedia Connection, with the newsletter, the daily media property. The chief content officer part is the part that is dedicated to the events, where I'm the counterpart of Drew Iani over at AdTech, which was your job before that. So that's why it's that crazy ampersand fused title.
Which one do you like better?
I don't. I can't choose among my children. They both inform the other. I will say that the intimacy of the events and the fact that they aren't, you know, slamming me on the head every day, as anyone who's worked in a daily media property knows, that's the name of the game. But on the other hand, there's something really lovely about working with an individual piece of prose over the course of time, working with a columnist week after week. And I have a very brilliant and dedicated team of editors who are sitting right outside my office, and that's another wonderful thing to work with. So I can't choose, but they do inhabit different parts of my head.
You've self-described your employment as a bizarre career trajectory. You've been in academia, you've been in Hollywood, you've done, of course, internet writing and marketing, and now you call yourself a marketing journalist. So tell us the story of Brad. Before we knew you as the iMedia guy, what's the academia?
Well, I started my professional life as a graduate student and a teacher, and I was a pretty good teacher. I won awards as a teacher at UC Berkeley. I've lectured about Shakespeare all over the world. I've worked at the Shakespeare's Globe Theater in London. My first website I hand-built for my students back in the mid-90s, but the first website I did that had any real outside-of-the-classroom traffic was a history of Shakespearean stage history, and I was a stage historian. And that introduction to Shakespearean stage history was used as a textbook from everywhere from South Africa to Florida, and it was a lot of fun. From there, when I decided to move on outside of the academy for lots of reasons, one of the chief ones being there was a 90% unemployment rate in the Shakespearean biz at that time, and it hasn't gotten any better. I was quickly snapped up as a story analyst at DreamWorks right when the company was founded, and I was there and doing freelance story analysis for a while at other places, including Sidney Pollack's company, New Regency, Bette Midler's company. There's a lot of different places, and it was a lot of fun. And then the bubble happened, and I got sucked into the internet. There was a very interesting company called Lineup Technologies, which was kind of YouTube, before there was bandwidth for the internet. And it was doomed, like so many dot-coms were. And then I wound up as the digital editor at Earthlink, the ISP, for 4 years. That started in 2000, and then I got snapped up by iMedia about 3 years ago.
So one of the things that your work in Shakespeare taught you was that you believe that Shakespeare invented the modern audience. How?
It's interesting because you've just jumped to the heart of the way in which my crazy career path actually makes sense. Because if you were on your iPod listening to this interview and you rewound the last couple of minutes and you listened to all of that again, you would think, okay, he was at Berkeley, he was in Hollywood. The guy has no stick-to-itiveness. I'm like a ping-pong ball. And yet, essentially, I've only been interested for the last 10 years in one intellectual question, and that is what people do with the media they consume. You are what you read. You are what you watch in the same way that you are what you eat. And the modern audience is the audience that takes materials and does things with them because they don't know the producers. If your daughter, I think you have a 10-year-old, creates a painting, it comes to you with a context. You not only know what's on the paper, the colors, but you know the mind that created it. Whereas if you create something and you send it out through mass culture, what you're doing is you are the creator, a fixed point within the culture, and you enable the most interesting thing about interacting with the same pieces of media over the course of time, the same media brands. And that's this. If you look at the Mona Lisa once, then that's fine. But if you look at it twice, you're not only looking at it at this time, but you're having the memory of it before. That's called cognitive funding or aesthetic funding. And Stephen Pepper, who was a historian and art critic at Berkeley, invented that idea. Cognitive funding is the biggest thing about what happens as you watch the Bond movies over the course of time, as you follow a particular actor across different roles. It's the way that a brand, and whether it be an advertising brand or a media brand or a narrative brand, can bond itself to its audience most clearly. And it's the thing that's most threatened by the fragmentation of media and culture that we're experiencing today. And that's not just the internet's fault. That started with cable TV and lots of other things. Shakespeare was the first person to really do that because he was the guy who had a four-pronged relationship with his audience. He was the author of the play. He was the part owner of the company of players, the part owner of the building that they played in, and he was one of the actors. So he was a stable point in the reference of the audience. Does that make any sense?
Well, Shakespeare was vertically integrated. I just got that part of it. I also think what you're saying is that because Shakespeare wrote so many plays and was in so many parts of the production, that over time he was able to build a bond to his brand through the repetition of his connection with his audience.
Exactly. And the more you went, the more associations you had with that experience, and therefore the richer and more satisfying your experience. And because your experience going to the Globe was richer, you wanted to go back. Everybody always wants to feel like an expert. It's a very gratifying feeling. So if there are ways of making your audience feel like experts by giving them a great frame of reference, you're going to bond them to.
So what's your notion of this anatomization of content? And say it right for me, Brad. I read your article about it, and I'd love you to explain it to us, because I think it hooks into the bond to the brand.
Well, the anatomization of content, and that's the closest I can get to saying it, is very clearly understood simply by looking at what iTunes did to the concept album. I'm old enough to remember Pet Sounds. I think many of the people listening to this are. Sgt. Pepper, the other great concept album of the 60s. Those were albums in which the transition from one song to the next was significant, and the cumulative result of listening to the entire album, the entire CD, the entire collection of songs, was greater than the sum of the individual parts. That is the phenomenon. That experience has been completely destroyed by iTunes. Now, iTunes is great, and they get a tremendous amount of my money, but it is more difficult for people to experience a work in its context, in its oeuvre, within the artist's entire creative bent, or simply within the confines of that individual collection of songs. What happens there is happening increasingly across other media. So if you look at YouTube breaking up the good bits from last night's Daily Show or individual scenes from shows, there's just a lot of drive to break things down to its core and component parts. This is a challenge for that kind of audience bonding that I was talking about before with the consumers of media. It's also a real challenge for advertisers, because advertisers want to have a stable group of people that they can get their messages in front of, and that makes it hard.
Right, a stable audience that repeats, that you can create a bond to your brand by continuing to show up.
Right, and without that brand, everything gets commoditized on the media side, but also it drives commoditization of products as well. So if you're trying to say, you BMW drivers, you're going to like this kind of media, that's fine. But search and media fragmentation, they make all soft tissues into which you blow your nose the same, and it's harder to differentiate and say that Kleenex is somehow better.
So anatomization, what is anatomization? Is that like an anatomic, something anatomic? What does that mean?
Like anatomy?
Uh-huh.
Like it's breaking something down to its components.
Classification, breakdown. Got it. Okay. And one of the things that you've also stated is that you think mass culture is on a diet, that mass is going away. And you talk about media tribes. How does that all connect into this thing you love, which is watching audience?
Well, media tribes is something I adopted, and I'm trying to remember who invented it. I thought it was a provoking idea, and so I linked to it in my blog, which is called Mediavorous, like carnivorous only with media. I must confess I've lost track of the first part of your question because I was intent on giving credit where it is due to media tribes. What was the question?
My question was media tribes. If we have this anatomization, you got to come up with a better word. I can't say that thing.
Anatomization.
If we have this kind of breaking down into its core elements of media, everything becoming bite-sized, audiences are now fractured into these millions of little pieces, and they come and they go, and there's no sustainable time to build them. You also talked about media tribes. That makes me think about swarms and hordes and groups of people that have consumption patterns. And I wanted you to explain what media tribes were and how it fit into this story that you're unfolding for us.
Well, it was the Atkins diet comment, I think, that was at the heart of that question. And that is something you can track very simply by looking at numbers. The number one television show right now is a pale reflection of the number one television show, 10 years ago, and certainly it's infinitesimally small compared to 25 years ago. The Bob Newhart Show, the original Bob Newhart Show, when it first ran back in the day, was getting numbers that the Super Bowl would be proud of today. And so when there is still mass culture, and insofar as you are what you read, you are what you consume, people who do consume things together have a shared context. The context for sharing is much slimmer. There are fewer and fewer shows that everyone watches. There are fewer and fewer shows that everyone recognizes. And that means that without a nation of media consumption, we're really breaking down into more geographic and individual tribes of media consumption. Although in this case, geography is a very bad metaphor, I should say, because so much of the consumption is cross-geography because people are watching things, consuming things, and then they're sustaining their communities online. That's one of the greatest things about the Internet, the growth of online community. And there's a very exciting program at USC called the Charles Annenberg Program in Online Community. I'm an advisor to them. And they're actually taking kids and turning them into masters in communication management people with online community as a focus.
We're going to take a short break and stop right there because I want to come back and talk to you about a couple of other media-related things, and then I want to get into more Brad Behrens things. So for all of you listening, we're talking to Brad Behrens. He's the editor-in-chief and, oh gosh, the chief content officer of iMedia Communications. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. We're going to take a short break right now to thank our sponsors, and we'll be back.
Listen to Evolutionary Sales, integrating 21st century psychology with ethical sales techniques. A daily audio program to make your explosive success not just possible, but predictable on personallifemedia.com.
We're back. This is your host, Susan, and I'm with Brad Behrens. And when we were just before the break talking about media and media consumption and media audiences, I want to flip this to you a little bit, Brad, and ask you about you being in the media. If there was a place for you to be recognized in the media, what would that outlet be and what would they say about you?
Well, if you mean how does the media talk about me?
I mean, if you could, okay, so I'll just give an example. I was written up in the New York Times about 3 weeks ago. Bob Tedeschi did a fabulous article on personal life media on my ad format, The Surround Session, and podcasting. It was just half page. It had a great photo. I looked skinny. I loved it. It was like the penultimate press coverage for me. It was my dream piece. That's my dream piece. What's yours? What do you want to be in, and what do you want people to say? What do you want that outlet to say about you?
It's such a funny question because I'm always...
I know, you're
surprised.
A journalist.
I'm always surprised when someone does reach out to me. I'm an old teacher, and so for me, the ability to act as a translator, almost regardless of the venue, is the thing that really floats my boat. I've been very privileged and pleased to be invited by Anheuser-Busch, for example, to come in and hang out with them for a day. I opened up an internal summit that they did, and then they kept me around and asked me to kind of just, you know, stay there and answer questions and give my perspective, and that was really a lot of fun. A couple of reporters from USA Today have discovered that I'm handy because I can try to explain what the real story is, and I really like that. I don't, you mentioned in the introduction I'm writing a novel, and so I have the same vain hunger for fame of that kind. But in my capacity at iMedia, and this is getting back to something I was talking about before, it's really all about the mission. And so whatever the context, I'm pretty happy. There's nothing that quite duplicates the thrill of talking in front of a live audience. And I really do like that, and so I'll go to extreme lengths to make sure that every single transition on that PowerPoint deck is going to work and that the jokes are in the right places and that there's some takeaway for people. I don't know if this is answering your question. I certainly am enjoying this conversation, and I have no particular dream of being interviewed in the New York Times, but I would enjoy the experience a great deal if it happened.
Well, you're not vain. You like to be in service. You don't have some big press thing you want. Maybe you want your novel, which I want to get to in just one second. You would like to have your novel perhaps in the New York Times top 10 bestseller list. That might be good. But you do have a vanity Google alert, as do I. And I wonder how many other listeners have one. So why don't you just briefly describe what they are so everyone can say, oh, well, if I don't have one, I need to get one.
Well, if you're in the public eye at all, then you can ask Google to track what you do and let you know when people are writing about you. And because I give a lot of talks, and because one of the things that's very easy to have happen to you if you do give a lot of talks is you can be misquoted, but also I'm just always curious about the impact of what I have to say. And so I have you set it up, you have to have an iGoogle page or a Gmail. It takes about 3 minutes to do. And it's handy. I do believe in the things that I talk about. I do believe that I have things to say about the nature of media, about what media matters, about how to create media that's going to be impactful with people, that's going to sustain them, and that incidentally, in wearing my iMedia hat, is going to be a good canvas for an advertiser and worth an advertiser's support. So although I claim at least not to be hugely vain, I do believe in what I'm selling. And so tracking the impact of what that is, whether it be in iMedia, on stage, or on the blog, is handy. So that's why I have one, and many people do, and it's a lot of fun. There is, however, also a guy named Brad Behrens, who I've spoken with, who runs an old age home a few miles north of me in Santa Clarita. And there's also a Brad Behrens who is a high school band leader in North Dakota. So far, we're not getting each other's mail, but we do get each other's Google alerts.
I Google alert not only myself but my husband. So I have a familial alert on all of that. So let me put you into your kneeling chair.
Yes.
Go with me on this.
Oh, you have been reading the blog. Thank you.
You like one of those old 80s style chairs that has no arms and no back and is cantilevered, and you put your butt in it and then you lean forward and you kind of kneel a bit, right?
Only when I'm writing fiction.
Yes. So you're in your kneeling chair. You're
mm-hmm.
You're writing fiction. You have been working on your novel. It's called Red Cross with an E, Red Crossy. We'll find out about that. And this is a novel that's set in the near future. You walk in and you sit down and finally you're off the grid. You have figured out how to remove all distractions. You're picking up your novel and you're ready to write again.
Yes.
And you realize that it's been so long since you wrote that the near future is now.
Well, there are some things that I was imagining 10 years ago in 97 when I first had the idea for this particular story that have come to pass, or some things that are growing towards it. Red Cross, I don't like speaking about it in too great detail because it still is so much a work in progress. I will say it's set 15 or 20 years in the future. And the key component of the universe that's worth talking about is that it's a universe in which your health insurance and your credit card have become the same thing. So if you have high cholesterol and you buy a pizza with your Visa card, your health insurance premium goes up. Which is a quietly funny and yet really terrifying idea for lots of people. We do suffer from, in this country, a grave crisis in our healthcare system.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that people are starting sort of to talk about, and it becomes particularly important around election time. But for the most part, I think the average person, the average worker, the people who do the work and who live our lives in this country, are getting pinched more and more by a vastly inequitable an overly expensive system. And there's a lot of anxiety that I feel about this. I come from a medical family. My dad's a doctor. And so part of my frustration and anger about healthcare and what's happening in this country is what drove me to start writing the book. That, however, makes it sound like a very, very grim story indeed, but I actually think it's kind of funny. It's an adventure. It's a thriller. The protagonist is a young woman who was a former cop who's now finding herself trying to look for new work. I've had so many career changes that during one rather painful one, I kind of came up with this character. And that's about all I really want to say about it. But the point about the kneeling chair and having a new filter on the computer, a new user profile, is that I have so much going on in my my professional life. There, you know, it's an extraordinary embarrassment of riches in terms of the number of brilliant people I get to chat with every day. And at home, I have my family, who I just adore and who just returned after 2 weeks away, so I'm extraordinarily happy right now, that I have to come up with some way of isolating myself, even if only for a few minutes a day, and having a different chair and no distractions and a different user profile on the computer without email, without instant messenger, without Skype. Those are all things that I can do so that when I do sit down finally to think about writing, I can think about writing.
Well, and you didn't mention your latest addiction, which is Facebook.
Oh, God, yes.
What do you like about it?
Facebook is terrifically fun. It's a huge time suck.
Yeah.
The thing about Facebook that makes it different is the thing that got them into such trouble about a year ago, which is the feed. Every time one of your friends changes something, there's a little note, and this is what provoked undergraduates to dub it stalker book back in about a year ago. That is the thing that they got in lots of trouble for. They're getting in trouble again this week because they're starting to put ads into the content well. But the thing that is so interesting is the trivial presentness of Facebook. You know, people do this. People who should know better, who are, you know, officers in corporations, say things like, yeah, I'm a little hungover today. But they say it and they publish it within their private network.
Mm-hmm.
You can have the impression of being close with people, of actually keeping up with them on Facebook because everyone's publishing these little details. And it means that because it's a casual environment, the way email used to be, then I can drop a quick note to someone and say, hey, I'm trying to figure this out. Do you have any insight about this? And it's not the same as, if you'll forgive me for an overweening metaphor, Brad speaking ex cathedra as the editor-in-chief of my media. If I send somebody a note from that email address, then I'm kind of on the record in a big way. Whereas if I do a drive-by in Facebook, it's much more casual and people are less alarmed, and it's kind of nice.
It's definitely a humanizing application, and it reminds me when you said the trivial presentness of Facebook that David Weinberger was on Dishy Mix. It just aired this week, so you probably haven't heard it yet. One of the things I love about you, Brad, is that you listen to the show. He said something, we were talking about Twitter. He's a big Twitterer. He really likes that application, as do I. And he called it the intimacy, I'm paraphrasing, but he called it Twitter the intimacy of detail. That being able to, we connect with so many people on a business level, but actually being able to show your humanity in the detail of your picayune day is something that creates a much greater intimacy. And I actually think that's what Facebook does too.
I had no idea, for example, that tomorrow, and we're recording this on a Thursday, that tomorrow is Nick Denton's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. And, you know, Nick is an instant messenger buddy and a Facebook friend and a guy that I've had lunch with, a guy I like a lot. But I send a note to his cell phone, happy birthday a day early. By the way, blame Facebook. And that's cool.
Yeah.
And sure, the trivialities of detail, and I just ordered David's new book, so I'm looking forward to it.
Small Pieces Loosely Joined?
I thought it was The Miscellaneous.
Oh, yeah, Everything is Miscellaneous. That's his latest one. That's right. Yep, Everything is Miscellaneous. Yeah, that's the one about how we're organizing things on the Internet. I like that.
Well, I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And there's a wonderful book called The Perfect Mess by Abramoff and Friedman that I'm in the middle of. Things can be so relentlessly ordered on the Internet that a certain amount of randomness is desired in life because that's where inspiration and the collision of different ideas come from. And that's the kind of cool thing about Facebook is two friends might update their profiles at the same time, and you might think, you know, those two should meet each other, and the only conduit through which they're going to meet each other is through you, and that can be great.
Well, that's a perfect segue for me. I want to meet Joseph Karabas. I don't know him, but Jim Stern. You know Jim Stern from...
Of course.
Yeah, I love Jim Stern.
From eMetrics.
Yes, from eMetrics. Jim, and from Target Marketing of Santa Barbara, Jim was saying to me, you know who would be really good on Dishy Mix is Joseph Karabas. And then I was reading your blog, and you were blog linking to Joseph and some of the things he was saying. And I'm like, all right, I got to meet this guy. What do you like about Joseph Karabas?
Well, Joseph is, just to back up, Joseph is the chief research officer and founder of two companies called Next Stage Evolution and Next Stage Marketing? Next Stage, I forgot the other one, but Next Stage. He's the Next Stage guy, and he'll beat me about the head and shoulders for having forgotten the name of the second company. He's a close friend of mine. We were introduced by Rob Graham, who I think you know.
Oh, yeah. I used to work with Rob.
And Rob, who's the author of Fishing Where the Fish Are, or Shooting Fish in a Barrel, something, a wonderful book about, and I had it on my shelf, but someone borrowed it to read it, so I had to lend it out, about behavioral targeting. Rob introduced me to Joseph a few years ago. He's written a twice-monthly column for iMedia, and he is, and I don't use this word lightly, Susan. Joseph is a genius.
Wow.
He has a truly unique perspective on all sorts of things, and he's lived quite a life. He, you know, he's been everything from a truck driver to a butcher to, you know, a chief scientist in residence. He gives lectures at universities all over the world, and he really has an extraordinary viewpoint into how the mind processes information online.
Mm.
And he comes at things from such a distinct point of view that people, when he comes and lectures at iMedia, they're just sort of, you know, agape. And he's also a lot of fun. Now, I come at things from a much more literary perspective, and we tend to complement each other, so we wind up having our blogs intersect and having lovely conversations because our brains are at least interested in the same things and come at them from different channels. He's a lovely guy. He's living in New Hampshire right now. He also flies kites that are as big as my car.
Oh, I love that. I see those out at the Shoreline Amphitheater here in Northern California, and they're spectacular.
Yeah, that's one of his hobbies, and there's no such thing as a boring conversation with Joseph. So I do think he would be a terrific guest, but you probably want to start off by having a couple of websites that you guys will talk about so that your readers or listeners can be looking at them at first, because it's always most productive if you start from a very concrete place and then you get into the ethereal outside.
Quick ethereals. All right, good. Well, we have to wrap this up. I want to ask you one question, and then I have a request of you at the end.
Sure.
My final question for you is, why did you keep the 80,000 comic books that are currently stored in your attic and garage? And why did you sell your award-winning Shakespearean book collection?
Ah, well, you know, my wife...
I knew it was going to be something about your wife.
No. I would say my wife shares your first question, which is
why do you keep the
comic books. I sold the Shakespeare books because we were selling a lot of books, and because I'm an acquisitive guy, not in the sense that I need to have jewels or, you know, or Armani coats, but I mean, I'm an aggregator, and I had Shakespeare as a hobby when I was a kid, and then as an abiding interest in college, and then it became my job. And so there was all of this stuff. And we had, 35 boxes of books that we sold to Powell's about a year ago. And at a certain point, having left behind me the career part of the Shakespeare, I thought, okay, what's the kind of core nub of the things that you really still think about, Brad? The stuff that means something to you, the part that is a key component of your mind. I kept that stuff. And that was, you know, a good, solid bookcase. But the rest of it, the stuff that you don't really respect, but you know you need to have it because other people are going to cite it, or this sort of thing over here, which is okay, but you're never going to think about it again. That's the stuff that I thought might actually be useful to other people, because there are lots of people still squirreling away professionally in Shakespeare studies. And it turned out that people would pay me a lot of money for those things. And so I sent them off, and it was a great experience. The comic books, I have this fantasy that one day I will organize them all and that I'll, you know, reduce by at least half. And now that I've said that sort of on the record, I'm sure that my lovely wife, Kathy, will get this particular snippet of Dishy Mix and put it on our answering machine outgoing message. I have this fantasy that I'm going to go through them all and get rid of them. The problem is I've been collecting comic books since I was five. And there are some habits that are hard to break. It could be worse. You know, I could be collecting things that are larger or more expensive.
Good justification.
All right. I'm trying as fast as I can.
Here's my request. This is our closing moment here.
Sure.
Before we got on the line and recorded the show today, you and I talked for a few minutes just to get our levels set and everything, and you made an offer to me. And I would like to take you up on that offer now on behalf of our listeners. You offered to sing some Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, good heavens. I was only joking. I haven't sung in many, many years. So be the very model of a modern major editor, but I am certainly not going to do that in song. But thank you. I will, however, comply with the request that you made when we were talking several days ago, which is I will confess that when you were interviewing someone else, it might have been David Cowan, who was so fascinating, or possibly at the moment that Rex Briggs was confessing that he has very loud shoes and very fast cars, I thought to myself, I wonder if Susan will ever call me and ask me to be on Dishy Mix. Gosh, that sounds like lots of fun. So I want to say thank you so much for inviting me.
I am so happy to have you on, Brad. It was really fun to get to know more about you. You have many delightful layers in your personality, which is strong, strong, strong. So thanks for sharing yourself with our industry and our listeners today. It was great to have you.
It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for enjoying our time together, Brad and I. And you are listening to Dishy Mix, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. You can subscribe in iTunes. Just search on Dishy Mix. Or you can subscribe in RSS at my site, which is personallifemedia.com. I have a companion blog to Dishy Mix. It's dishymix.com. Not bad, huh? And you can always send an email to me with comments or questions about the show, Susan@personallifemedia.com. For text and transcripts of the show, we also have those on personallifemedia.com. So pretty much anything you need is there. I look forward to your comments, and please call and email me. I'll look forward to talking to you next week as well. We'll have another interesting guest and another half hour of fun. Have a great day. Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.